Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Suzanne, you are a consultant in neurology in the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in London. You're a hugely respected expert in your field. You've written a number of award-winning medical books, and your new book is called The Age of Diagnosis, Sickness, Health, and Why Medicine Has Gone Too Far. And it's a terrific read. I think your basic thesis is that we're medicalizing too much of life, maybe pathologizing normal in a way. What were you seeing in your work as a doctor that got you thinking about this?
Yeah, so as a neurologist, I look after a lot of really young patients, you know, in their 20s, in their 30s. And over the course of the last kind of 10, 15 years, I see an accruing number of really young people who are gathering labels. Some people come to me with, you know, 5, 6, 7 different medical labels, and many of them don't seem to be making them any better. You know, they're being labeled with medical problems. A medical diagnosis or a label is supposed to lead to treatment and improvement, but these seem to be labels for label's sake.
Is there a sense these days that possibly because we all have the internet and Dr. Google and all that, that people kind of almost demand a diagnosis when they go to the doctor? Like, we feel you're being shortchanged if you don't get one.
I'm not absolutely convinced that it's made a big difference. I think people always went to their doctor demanding a diagnosis, but where they get their information is different now. So they kind of come to you with a different language and perhaps with more technical language than they would have in the past. But I don't think people are more desperate for answers now than they were in the past. Probably what's changed is, you know, we've got a lot more tests, we've got a lot more labels to give than we did 20, 30 years ago.
Okay, so let's take a few specific diagnoses then. We'll go in at the shallow end here. So do you think we are over-diagnosing and over-medicalizing depression?
Yeah, so the first thing to say is just to make sure people understand what I mean by overdiagnosis.
Okay.
So overdiagnosis doesn't mean a diagnosis is wrong. Overdiagnosis simply means that a diagnosis may well be right, but it's not necessarily beneficial. The harm of the diagnosis might outweigh the benefits of the diagnosis. And to directly answer your question, I do worry that we are overdiagnosing depression and a number of mental health conditions. This happens in physical medicine, in things like blood pressure and diabetes too. But in mental health diagnosis, we are gradually moving the limits of normal so that we're kind of drawing in healthy patients who or people who would have once been considered not to have a diagnosis by sort of subtly adjusting how what the degree of symptoms you need to have to qualify for the diagnosis. And we're doing that for good reason. We're doing that because we have a history of neglect. We have a history of stigmatizing people with mental health conditions and not helping people with mental health conditions. So I think it's driven by good intention, but it's gone too far. It's overcorrection.
So what, people who maybe have like the normal sadness of life, grief maybe, that kind of thing?
I mean, exactly. The bottom line is that we're all sad sometimes and we all have low mood sometimes. And for a low mood to qualify as being depression that requires medical attention, it should really be persistent for minimum 2 months, and it should affect your daily living. It should stop you doing things that you should be able to do in daily life. But I think we're kind of beginning to wander into referring to sadness that isn't so persistent and isn't so disabling as depression. And the problem is that when you call something a medical thing like depression, it hasn't the effect of kind of labeling a person. And when you label a person as sick, it can reinforce the symptoms. It can make them concrete instead of alleviating them.
Okay. Let's talk about autism. So we saw here just last week that autism diagnoses in Ireland are up 300% in the last decade. I think it's similar across the Western world, even more in a lot of countries. So are we getting better at diagnosing autism? Were we underdiagnosing it for years? Or have we broadened the criteria for diagnosis? Have we broadened them too much?
I mean, yes to all of those suggestions, but probably the latter, the broadening of the criteria, is probably the most, has had the biggest impact. So if you think 50 years ago or in the 1940s, autism was described as extreme autism aloneness, and the first children who were diagnosed with it were referred to as interested in people as they would be in bookshelves or filing cabinets. Now you can see that description does not apply to the type of people who are being diagnosed with autism now that include people like Elon Musk and Anthony Hopkins. So there's been this enormous sort of widening of what it means to have autism. You need considerably less impairment or disability now than you used to have, need to have, and you can get it in adulthood. So there's been all sorts of adjustments to the criteria to allow the diagnosis in more people. But I think that that has gone way too far.
OK, so that gives rise to several questions. So first, people will say, is this not a good thing? More kids getting the supports they need.
OK, so on the one hand, there was a chronic underdiagnosis problem. I went to school in the 70s, 80s. Nobody was recognised as having special learning needs then. And that cannot possibly, you know, in my class of 120, that can't be right. So there was clearly children who could have done better if they'd been recognised as needing support. That needed to be corrected. However, we've now gotten into a situation where some of the autism being diagnosed is so mild that it's not actually causing much impairment. If you have someone with a severe autism, they will definitely benefit from diagnosis or moderate autism because they're impaired by their diagnosis. But if you get into the really mild disabilities, then you do have the difficulty that you could be encouraging children to pay more attention to the things they can't do. You could be encouraging a child to have lower expectations for themselves. At the very mild end of the spectrum of autism, where the disability is very minimal, it could become a self-fulfilling prophecy if you label someone as autistic. And just to address...
But then people will say to you that... excuse me. People will say, getting an autism diagnosis, a lot of the time in adulthood, it certainly made sense of everything for them. Mm-hmm. It was a huge relief. They feel a kind of a validation.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to be really cautious about what happens after the validation. I mean, first of all, to come back to children for a second.
Okay.
So we've been increasing the number of people diagnosed with autism since the 1990s. So it's a good 20 odd years that we've been improved on our previous problem. In the UK, I'm not sure for the statistics for Ireland, but I'm sure they're comparable. 27% of school children get special accommodations in school. Now, the very definition of overdiagnosis is the diagnosis may or may not be right, but it's not helping. The premise for all these extra diagnoses was we'll improve mental health in young people, we'll improve long-term learning. Where's the evidence that's worked? The opposite is true. We actually now have a big population of children with autism and an even bigger population of young adults with depression. So if this concept of helping people in the very mild end of the spectrum was working, we're really not seeing the payoff. And I think we have to stand back and say, listen, it was well-intentioned, but is it working? And I suggest it isn't.
OK. Do you think the whole of society and the medical establishment has gone wrong here? Kind of an overcorrection, maybe?
I think it's a kind of a collusion between society and the medical establishment. You know, people are looking for answers and explanations. You know, they see their child struggling. They want to understand. They want to help them. And medicine has become perceived as being a way to help people. Labels have become perceived as a way to help people. And then the research and scientific community has sort of responded to that. You know, they've said, well, OK, we'll adjust these criteria to find more children and more children. And I don't think they're being objective enough to stand back and say, is it working? Because there's quite a lot of evidence it isn't.
OK, so am I right in thinking you work with a lot of young people with autism, or you come across them in your work?
Yeah, I work with people with brain diseases and epilepsy, many of whom have autism. Yeah, but,
can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
Do you think that people like, you mentioned Elon Musk, and a lot of high profile people now talk about their autism, Is that helpful to the young people you work with in destigmatizing or whatever?
Yeah, no, I mean, thank you for mentioning that, because, you know, it's one of my big concerns, really, is when the public face of autism has really started to trivialize what autism is for the more moderately or severely affected person. Autism is a terribly difficult problem to live with, and it's terribly difficult if your children are affected. So first of all, when we start talking about people at the level of Anthony Hopkins having autism, it really doesn't portray the true story of autism, not to mention the fact that it attracts resources away from the people who need it most. We now have severely autistic people unable to access education because schools are catering better for mildly autistic. But the third thing it does that's very problematic is we now have such a wide range of what it means to have autism that if you try to do scientific research and you're comparing someone with severe autism with someone, you know, at the level of Elon Musk, well, then you've got such a heterogeneous population. The chances that you'll ever find anything meaningful in your research is very little.
So is the notion of the autism spectrum disorder like... So does a person who has what we might call mild autism, do they actually have that much in common with someone called severe autism? Is it stupid to for them both to be called the same thing? Yeah. Like,
I think it's so difficult because the words are so difficult, aren't they? I mean, there is a thing called mild autism, but I think the thing called mild autism that has similar traits to severe autism is now blending into... people who are just have differences that are being considered autistic. And I think the further we wander into the milder and milder and milder forms, the less the newly diagnosed people have in common with the originally described condition. And that just makes research and supporting people really hard to do.
OK, so what a lot of those people will say, the people who do function in the world, they'll say, yes, I can function, but only because I'm masking my autism all the time. And this is exhausting and it's, you know, corrosive to me.
Yeah. I mean, I admit that I find the concept of masking very problematic. So for people who don't know what it is, it's also called camouflaging. So it essentially means that you have the sort of social communication difficulties of a person with autism, but you're able to compensate for them so you don't appear outwardly autistic. And it's said to be an exhausting thing. The difficulty is that concept has been stretched to the limit really now, because certainly moderately severe people with autism can learn social rules and can be told if you're in a particular situation, don't forget to ask questions back, for example. That's how it was originally coined. But it's now being used in such a way as to allow the diagnosis in people who do not have any apparent autistic traits at all, so that a person can say, well, I have no outward traits because I'm socially compensating. Well, what's the difference between socially compensating and what we all do, which is learn how to behave in the world and learn the rules of the world? So I think masking is a concept that has been stretched to the point of ridiculousness sometimes.
Okay. All right. So another one, and this will be contentious as well, I think, for a lot of people, ADHD. Another increasingly common diagnosis, especially now in adults. Do you believe there is overdiagnosis there? Again, probably at the mild end of ADHD.
Yeah, I mean, the overdiagnosis of these disorders is always at the mild end. It's interesting, you know, medical disorders at the severe end, and I'm talking, you know, physical diseases as well as these sorts of medical problems, they never really expand at the severe end. It's always at the mild end where the diagnosis is a bit uncertain that expansion tends to occur, because there's no objective line in the sand that says stop diagnosing at this point. Our temptation as society is to just keep diagnosing and keep diagnosing. I certainly would worry that ADHD is overdiagnosed. That is not to say that people who have difficulties don't have those difficulties, but whether those difficulties are caused by a brain disorder called ADHD is really in doubt, because there's no objective evidence to prove that ADHD exists in adults.
Okay, so you mean as a brain disorder? So
yeah.
I think we tend to think that it is to do with dopamine regulation. Yeah, the biology of the brain. Is there not evidence for that?
No, I mean, there's no good evidence for any biological. So there's lots of, obviously, in medicine, the way scientific research works is you'll find a handful of papers that will seem to support any argument. But the overwhelming kind of breadth of the evidence doesn't show any consistent brain abnormality in ADHD. Now, you can find differences. So if you compare a scan of one person who doesn't have ADHD with somebody else who does, you might see differences in those scans. But differences are not abnormalities. You know, if you compare two people with different kinds of personalities, you might also find differences.
Okay.
But I think sometimes these differences that we find on in research are kind of presented as a cause or an abnormality, but they're really just reflection of that person's experience. Doesn't mean it's a disease.
Okay, which brings us to, you have an issue, I think, with the notion of the word neurodiversity versus neurotypical. Neurodiversity, not actually a medical term, you point out in the book.
No. I mean, I think a lot of people, because it sounds quite medical, and that was the point of it, really. It was coined by a sociologist called Judy Singer. I've got the exact quote in The Age of Diagnosis, but I can't. So her quote of how she came up with the term is more or less this, but this isn't exact. She said she realized that psychotherapy was becoming a bit of a joke, and that she realized that neuroscientists were the new priesthood. And she thought biodiversity seemed to be getting a lot of attention at the moment. So she thought, well, let's put neuro and diversity together. And maybe then, you know, the experiences I'm having will be taken seriously. So it was literally a term that was coined in order to give a sort of biological sounding name to a set of difficulties. I don't have any problem with neurodiversity per se, because what it's saying is that we're all diverse. And sure, that's right. Of course, we're all different. That's my difficulty, is that it's used as a counterpoint to the term neurotypical. So it's sort of saying that some of us are diverse, but somewhere in the middle, there's this bunch of people who are typical, who can negotiate the world pretty easily, who know the social rules, who don't need to be taught them. But I think any of those us who would be considered typical would probably say we also have endless amounts of difficulties socially too. So I'm happy for us all to be considered diverse, but I'm not happy for us to be broken into diverse and typical.
OK, but then again, people who would identify as neurodiverse would say that once they got that label or diagnosis or whatever, they would often say, like, I found my tribe. This is who I am. I feel more at home in the world.
Yeah. I mean, and that's sort of a problem, isn't it? Because, you know, I completely understand that people get a great deal of validation and relief from the diagnosis. And I absolutely don't want anyone to feel they have to relinquish a diagnosis or a label that they genuinely feel benefits them. But what I do want to say to people is that, you know, along with that validation, a lot of people are identifying very strongly as having a particular medical diagnosis like ADHD or autism. And also, they say they've found their tribe, as you've said. The difficulty with identifying with a label like that so strongly is that it reinforces the difficulties. It's like what we call the nocebo effect. So the opposite of the placebo effect. Placebo makes you feel, something makes you feel better if you believe it will make you feel better. The nocebo means that something can make you feel worse if you believe it will make you worse. If you believe that you are neurodiverse, and that means that you cannot do A, B and C, it will basically reinforce your inability to do those things, and in a child in particular, might threaten your ability to overcome them. So I know this feeling of validation feels like a relief to people, but I just caution people about where that can lead. I also worry a little about this concept of people belonging to a tribe of neurodiverse people, because that means that your belonging to a group is predicated on your inability to do things. Well, how are you going to move forward in your life or change or do anything differently if being in the group requires you to have a certain set of difficulties?
Yeah, you talk in the book about an illness identity versus a recovery identity. Mm. You say ADHD used to have a recovery focus rather than an illness identity.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, ADHD in adulthood is a really new thing. So ADHD has been diagnosed in children for a long time. And the understanding when it was first coined was that it started disappearing in adolescence as people matured. But now we've created ADHD in adulthood. And that sort of erodes. It's very important that people know what recovery looks like and can believe in recovery if they're going to move forward. But if we're now creating a population of people with ADHD who are adults, we are eroding that recovery identity for children.
Okay, so they're not thinking that I will grow or learn my way out of it. Okay, interesting. Can we talk about screening a bit as well? One thing I was interested in, you have a section on screening fetuses, which is another big growth area in medicine, and everything from screening for Down syndrome to creating designer babies. You pose the question, look, why is everyone so fixated on Down syndrome?
Yeah, well, I suppose I've always wondered that. I mean, I understand that Down syndrome comes as a range of difficulties, and not every person is able to carry a Down syndrome child to term, because pregnancies do are less likely to be successful. So there's a range of difficulties in Down syndrome. But I think, you know, of all the different types of disabilities in the world, I regret using the word disability, to be honest. I mean, differences of all the different genetic differences in the world, you know, people with Down syndrome live incredibly fulfilling lives and fulfill the lives of others. So I suppose my concern here is that we've always had a screening program for Down syndrome. I suppose the only reason, to my mind, that it has become the focus of screening is because it's easy to screen for, because it's a genetic abnormality we've been able to detect since the 1950s. It's not a worse genetic difference to live with than other things. It's just very diagnosable to medicine. And my concern now is that, you know, we've screened for it for a long time, but it used to be that if you had a high risk of Down syndrome fetus, that you had to have amniocentesis to move the diagnosis forward.
Now, which carried a little bit of risk.
Yeah, that's a risk of it's invasive, it's unpleasant, and there's a risk of miscarriage. So obviously, before anyone would have amniocentesis, they'd think very deeply about whether they wanted it. But we now have a non-invasive blood test that will potentially detect Down syndrome. That's really problematic to me, in the sense that, you know, once you have a test that's super easy to do and that isn't dangerous at all, because this is just a blood test on the mother, it has no danger at all to the pregnancy, it can be routinized very easily.
So do you think it's inevitable that, which a lot of people do, I think a lot of people look at kids now and think they're probably the last generation of people with Down syndrome, is going to be screened out of existence?
I mean, it really worries me, because it really worries me that could happen, because the simplicity of the test is being allowed to kind of eclipse the seriousness of the purpose of the test. And in Iceland, Down syndrome has all but disappeared in Iceland. And in European countries where abortion is readily available, 90% of Down syndrome children are now, fetuses, I should say, are now terminated.
Yeah, so interesting. Yeah. You should say that. So we have a child with Down syndrome, but I remember years back, the code that people would use to my wife was, did you know? And eventually she decided, with older people, she lets it slide. With the younger people, she eventually started saying, well, actually, I don't answer that question. Because I think her point was, she'd always say, well, what are you suggesting I should have done with that information? Like, what are you saying here, you know? Yeah. But it does seem to be now a norm with a lot of people that, well, Jesus, if you knew, you know. Can we talk about cancer screening as well, just maybe briefly, because there's a bit more I want to get through, and time is against us. We tend to think the more cancer screening, the better. Catch it early, all that kind of thing. You don't necessarily agree. No.
Well, I'm not alone in not agreeing. This is debate within medicine for decades. I mean, the bottom line, I don't want to scare anyone away from screening. Please have your screening, but just be aware of the facts. The facts are that in order to screen for cancer, you will always overdiagnose. So let's say if you screen 2,000 women for breast cancer, you'll save one life from breast cancer, but you'll overdiagnose 10 other women. 10 women will be treated for breast cancer that didn't really need treatment. And that's the same for prostate cancer, for melanoma. For, I mean, it's the reason they don't do prostate cancer screening as routine now is because they weren't saving any lives, but they were treating, you know, huge numbers of men for prostate cancer without saving lives. The reason being that we all have abnormal cells. As we get older, huge numbers of us have abnormal cells in our body that will never progress to anything. An autopsy study in Detroit showed that 45% of men over the age of 50 had early prostate cancer cells in their prostate. Now, if those men had had screening, they could potentially have been treated for prostate cancer that never needed to be treated.
And the treatment for prostate cancer can have all kinds of very life-changing
Absolutely.
Kind of things. Yeah, actually, so I had like polyps or whatever you call them, or sometime removed it once. The guy said to me afterwards they were precancerous. Mm. Completely freaked me out. Because, right?
yeah.
you know, once you hear the word cancer, but then you go away and you realise, no, actually, you
Absolutely.
Know, sure, we're all precancerous, yeah.
And you know what? The language is important, because they call all of these cells cancer. And sure, how is a person supposed to react when they hear that word? You know, if I heard that I had cancer cells, I would want to act urgently. And one argument is to say that some of these cells, we should just have a different name for them, so they're not as terrifying and people will feel able to watch and wait for a while.
The last thing I wanted to talk to you about was that we can do all kinds of screening ourselves now as well. So tests to see our genetic predisposition to various conditions. Like I looked up, you can get a DNA Alzheimer's disease home kit now, which will you can do at home and send it off, and it'll tell you, you know, what your chances are. It's a whole vista is opening up for us to know about our future.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on that?
Don't do it.
Okay.
Do not do it. First of all, with regards to some of the, you know, whatever about getting a genetic test in a hospital with a geneticist, some of the commercial tests, the techniques they use aren't even reliable. But also people underestimate. Let's say that you found out you had two copies of the gene that put you at risk of Alzheimer's. That's a 60% risk of developing Alzheimer's. Now, people underestimate the huge burden of living with knowledge like that. First of all, it's not a foregone conclusion you'll get it. And secondly, you know, I spoke when I was writing The Age of Diagnosis, I spoke to people at risk of Huntington's disease, which is a genetic condition, and families at risk of Huntington's 80 to 90% of them do not have the test. And the reason they don't have the test is because for decades, they've had the chance to understand the implications of living with a positive test. And they've realized that living with the hope that it will be negative is a way better choice than getting a 50-50 chance that it's positive and then living with that burden. Because the minute you think you're going to get a disease, you notice everything. You know,
yeah.
We all forget things from time to time. Let's say you think you're going to get Alzheimer's. What do you think you'll make of that? It will be really amplified by your anxiety.
Yeah, yeah. The Huntington's disease people were interesting, weren't they? Because it is a fairly catastrophic illness when it does hit.
It's
and then some people did choose to know for various reasons.
Some people do choose to know. And I think most of us would think, you know, if we had a 50-50 chance of getting Huntington's, which is an awful disease, I think most of us would think we would test. And the Huntington's disease community, until a test became available, they all thought they would test too. Very few of them test, because they go and speak to geneticists who do a great job of helping people understand what will happen to you if that test comes back as positive. You could end up living like a patient 30 years before any symptoms begin, and that's a devastating loss.
Okay. I'm just going to read a few texts, okay, to kind of fill out the conversation. So there's a mix of texts from people who feel reassured by what you're saying and people who feel kind of as if they're being dismissed. Like Nuala in Galway, this woman is being retrograde and unhelpful. After diagnosis comes understanding and self-compassion and a better ability to manage issues and move forward. Adam Harris from As I Am, which is Ireland's autism charity, says masking isn't something to be believed or disbelieved. It is a lived experience of many autistic people across our lives. The thicker the mask, the more substantial the impact on mental health. Better diagnosis means less masking, more self and societal acceptance. We've always had those who will invalidate autistic experience, which in fairness, I do not think you are doing really. And the real world consequences cannot be overstated. And you might want to say there, I'm sure you have huge compassion and you do work with people with autism.
Absolutely. And I'm absolutely not saying that anyone is suffering, but I am questioning whether it's the balance of harm versus benefit at that mild end of the spectrum. But that's not to say that someone doesn't need support.
As a former school principal and special education teacher, I agree fully with the doctor you're interviewing. As a society, we are currently obsessed with acquiring diagnosis for children. Of course, giving a label can help some children, particularly children with severe difficulties. But as a professional, I've seen parents spend time and energy getting diagnoses, sometimes to the detriment of the children. But I think in fairness, a lot of parents are desperately trying to get a diagnosis to get some educational help for their children a lot. Someone else says, as a teacher in a special needs school, it is very concerning to me how severe disabilities are diminished by overdiagnosis. And how so many teenagers learning to navigate the world are now shackled for life with a mild autism or social anxiety disorder for life. It's an important discussion. Thank you very much. Suzanne, it is a really important discussion. I think it's a terrific book, and I do think it will probably lead to a big conversation that's been, I think, been going on out there among people, but you have very bravely brought it into the public realm. The book is called The Age of Diagnosis, Sickness, Health and Why Medicine Has Gone Too Far. It's published by Hodder Press and it's written by Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan. Suzanne, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.